live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studio in New York City. You can go to GaryNoel.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com if you'd like to watch in. Today, I will be continuing with an extended conversation with a guest that I've had on twice now. She is Dr. Judy Wood, but I'm going to take this discussion in a different direction today. I'm going to be asking Dr. Wood, who is a former professor at Clemson University's Department of Mechanical Engineering, specializing in the research of thermal stress and deformation analysis with optical imaging and biomaterial composition and biomimicry. She is an expert in the field of optical methods of stress analysis to determine interference patterns and their effects. She's authored 60 peer-reviewed journals. What actually happened to cause the buildings at 9/11 to collapse? 1,500 physicists, engineers, structural engineers, architects have all signed on to the story that is officially given couldn't be the reality of what actually happened. So something else was at play here. We've heard her talk about, after examining 40,000 images, and we put those images up on GaryNoel.com and ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, tens of thousands of people have analyzed them and given us their critique, and they'll say things like, my goodness, it's right there to see. You see metal columns simply disintegrate. No heat, no compression, they simply disintegrate. So today I'm going to ask her, based upon her forensic investigation into how the World Trade Center towers tumbled, the actual technology that would have to be used to create this. And we're going to go through this technology in depth today, because we're going to talk about directed free energy technology and the evidence of it. We'll be looking at the work at Edward Leedskalin and Thomas Brown and John Hutchinson, slow bending of metals, shredding, fracturing, and gelification of steel, propulsion and slow and impulsive, melting without heat, metal luminance without heat, materials changing their elemental levels, and anti-gravity activity. This may sound like science fiction. I can promise you it is not. It is good scholarship, and it simply is another way of looking at reality. So that's coming up, and it'll be an extended interview. Today, I'm going to do a commentary from Michael Badder, Alternate. I'm going to do one of my own. I'm going to talk about record high radiation levels at the crippled Japan nuclear plant and a new study linking mountaintop removal to 60,000 additional cancer cases. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. And by the way, for those of you who say we don't really have to look at how we can make government more effective, I believe we do. And I believe that the two arguments on the right, they're against government of any size unless it's tiny and they control it. On the left, that governmental agencies are good and they help the public, both are oversimplifications. I believe that if we had an independent citizens' review of every agency of government and a mandate, review this governmental agency's programs and budget and see what are they doing that actually services the public's needs to help us in society, and what are they doing that actually undermines our well-being and merely increases our expenditures to them with nothing coming back in return. For example, just give you a couple of examples. I've given you the big examples, totaling over $2.5 trillion a year that are wasted in major corporate giveaways. and the unfair tax system that we have today and how to correct that with one flat tax and eliminate the IRS. I've given you all those. It's in these little irritating details. For example, a senior manager in the National Science Foundation went on 47 trips in just 2.5 years with a subordinate, and where nothing from this trip benefited the public. A Colorado contractor overcharged the National Science Foundation $14.2 million in indirect cost. There was a $315,000 bill spent, meaning the American public paid for it, to see if playing Farmville on Facebook to help people to make friends and keep them. $1 million was spent on how quickly new parents react to trendy baby names. $80,000 on why the same teams dominate March Madness. $480,462 determine whether boys are more likely to play with trucks while girls are more likely to play with dolls. $200,000 to determine if Turkish women wear veils because they are fashionable. $3 million to study shrimp on a treadmill. Now, this isn't made up. There are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these expenditures every year, totaling hundreds of billions of dollars. I gave you one example where the Halliburton is given $100 for every little bag of dirty laundry of the Marines or the Armed Forces to clean. How much does it cost to clean one duffel bag of dirty laundry? In reality, about 50 cents. Even in Manhattan, and I tried this, we filled up what would be equivalent to a duffel bag, took it to a local laundry, let them clean it and dry it, fold it, and picked it up. It was under $5. So they get $100 for every bag, and you're dealing with over 100,000 people. Well, this is how we end up spending hundreds of billions of dollars. We have nothing that benefits society at any level. It doesn't help our children, doesn't help us at any essential level. Why aren't we willing to acknowledge that we need government to work for us in ways that improve the quality of our lives, protect us from that which could undermine or harm us in the environment or healthcare, clean up our environment the way it should be? And we're not doing any of that. But instead, people don't like this debate. Now, as you know, we're getting to where they're starting the pitch for a universal vaccine. In this universal flu vaccine, they will have some H1N1. They will also have lots of mercury, thimerosal. They'll have anywhere between 24 to 48 micrograms of mercury. Any of that is toxic to the brain, even one microgram. In fact, go way beyond that, one part per billion. For those of you who watched the film that I did called Vaccine Nation, two things from that film. One, you saw the man who invented more vaccines than any other person in human history, Dr. Maurice Hillman, who worked for Merck. He, for example, he created the influenza vaccine and the hepatitis vaccine. It's just some. He created about 14 vaccines. He also oversaw the development of the Sabin polio vaccine. Just before his death, and for reasons that we do not know, he agreed to be filmed. And in this, it was like a mea culpa. It wasn't really a professional film. You had people laughing and talking on camera, something you would never do if you were doing it professionally. But he said that early on, he discovered that all of the vaccines contained SV40, simian virus 40, a very serious virus that can cause cancer. He then took the SV40 virus that was in the polio vaccine, and he injected into hamsters, and they developed cancer. He brought this to Sabin's attention, and he said in the filmed interview that Sabin really got very angry and said, what are we supposed to do? This is already out there. People are using it, and they decided to cover it up. Their logic was, in their minds, reasonable. They figured it would take anywhere from 20 to 50 years before people who, as children or young adults who got the polio vaccine, would end up manifesting the type of cancer that that would come from this, and no one would know that their cancer came from this vaccine. That would have remained true, and did remain true, until, under a Freedom of Information Act, a person who had some very unusual cancers and had no risk factors in their family or lifestyle. They didn't smoke, they didn't drink, they didn't have any cancer in their family, but this person came down with some rare cancers. They got the information, and this all came out in this Freedom of Information Act. And the government's explanation was that we don't want to panic the public by letting them know that millions of them have been given potentially cancer-causing agents. So when we took one part per billion, that's with a B, billion, that's an infinitesimal amount. So small you could not see it with a naked eye, so small it would be hard to be seen with a microscope at normal fraction. One part per billion of thimerosal dropped into an Olympic swimming pool would contaminate the entire pool. We showed under a microscope, and it's in the film, a neuron, a brain cell, being attacked by that one part per billion of thimerosal and immediately killed. So now we have absolute, irrefutable, unquestionable evidence that mercury kills brain cells. It will demyelinate the sheath of the nerves going into the brain. It will cause the destruction of synaptic transfers in the brain, which can affect speech, learning, attention, motor skills, and it is not always quick. It may take months, even 2 to 3 years, before the full effect of the mercury plays out. The government has said officially there is no connection between vaccines, their contents, the number of vaccines, and any problems at all. New evidence shows the government has been lying with malice aforethought. We have the evidence to prove otherwise, that vaccines are neither safe nor effective for any given individual. This is just the latest. This is from Ethan Huff from Natural News. I'll report this. It says, scientists hyping universal flu vaccine to perpetuate vaccine scam. Quote, influenza vaccination rates are on the decline as Americans increasingly learn not only that flu shots contain harmful additives like thimerosal, mercury, but also that they do not even work as claimed. One of the side effects of getting a flu shot is the flu itself. So in order to convince the public into believing that flu vaccines are useful and necessary, experts from the U.S. National Institutes of Health are now touting the advent of a universal flu vaccine currently in the works that will supposedly protect against all types of flu. According to USA Today, scientists are currently working on a universal flu vaccine that targets certain unchanging characteristics of flu viruses that are common among many strains. Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, says that the viral coatings of every flu strain contain some of the same universal characteristics. So it is theoretically possible, he says, theoretically, to design a vaccine that targets these universal characteristics and thus target virtually all flu strains. Quote, there are parts of the flu, a viral coat, that don't change. Okay. These are some of the glaring questions that stand out in this matter, since as many as us know, the vaccine industry has no intention of actually curing the flu, and thus killing the flu vaccine cash cow. But this is creating a vaccine industry where everyone will line up to get their vaccine. Let's face it, more and more Americans are growing reluctant to take vaccines just because their doctors and various public health agencies are telling them they should. Last fall, Consumer Reports studied revealed that flu vaccination rates are on the decline, with only about 37% of the respondents to the survey indicating they are planning to get vaccinated that year. Nearly half indicated that negative side effects were the primary reason why they plan to skip the shot. while roughly the same percentage expressed concern about the safety of flu vaccines in general. Many also claim that flu shots are probably not even necessary in the first place. And every year, an increasing number of people are expressing such sentiments as the number of willing volunteers for the flu shot continues to decline. Questioning the legitimacy of the flu shot is important. After all, the U.S. Center for Disease Control, and which many look at as the be-all, end-all source of health information, has basically admitted that flu vaccines are useless. This is why the agency says individuals need to be revaccinated every year. But even a cursory knowledge of how antibodies work in the human body proves that vaccines do not boost the immunity in the way that the CDC alleges. Otherwise, there would never be a need to get more than one vaccine. Then there's the inconvenient truth that flu vaccines are ineffective more than 99% of the time anyway. In other words, for every 100 people that get a flu shot, only one of them will derive any perceived benefit from it, and that 1% is a generous estimate. The natural result of all these facts, of course, is an overall decline in the number of people willing to get jabbed every single year. Now, the truth is that no vaccine is truly effective at preventing the flu, including any supposed universal flu vaccines. For example, it was shown that senior citizens who got the flu vaccine did not have any benefit. It didn't prevent any deaths that we were told would help if they got the vaccine, the same way with children. And yet, these are the two largest targeted groups. So why are they promoting vaccines for groups that their own studies acknowledge are not helping? So what will help? Well, how about building up your immune system, getting plenty of good vitamin D through natural sunlight, or consuming vitamin D3, a very effective way of strengthening your immune system, fight influenza naturally. How about also practicing proper hygiene? How about taking vitamin C each day and eating all the fruits and vegetables that you really can in a day and drinking juices? And then if you should feel your immune system faltering, how about getting proper rest and taking echinacea, astragalus, and pas de arco, all the nutrients in ginger that we know are beneficial against viruses? Unfortunately, that's the study they've never done. We've asked them to take 1,000 individuals who just take the vaccine. Take 1,000 individuals who take no vaccine but have a whole body immune modifying protocol using natural supplements and foods and beverages. Compare them for a year. See who comes down with flu and who doesn't, who gets sick and who stays well. That's really easy and inexpensive to do. Will they do it? Not on your life. I'm Gary Nall, and one thing, for those of you who are in the belief that this administration, well, they will do the right thing if they're just motivated enough. I can't tell you how many times I've heard the people Chris Matthews and others apologize for Obama, that it's really the Republicans pressuring him to make these bad decisions. No, it isn't. This man has been for 100% nuclear, gas fracking, deep water drilling, opening up our natural wildlife sanctuaries and public lands to companies to exploit the resources. And he was one of the major proponents and the key voice behind all those public service announcements on clean coal. Here's the latest on this. This is from alternate.org. New study links mountaintop removal to 60,000 additional cancer cases, and I'll quote this. Among the 1.2 million American citizens living in mountaintop removal mining counties in central Appalachia, an additional 60,000 cases of cancer are directly linked to the federally sanctioned strip mining practice. That is the damning conclusion in a release last night in the peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Community Health, the publication for health promotion and disease prevention. led by West Virginia University researcher Dr. Michael Hendricks, among others. The study, entitled Self-Reported Cancer Rates in Two Rural Areas of West Virginia, my home state, by the way, and I've been in all those counties, it shows this enormous increase in cancer. Bottom line, far from simply being an environmental issue, mountaintop removal is killing American residents. Quote, this research in the Coal River Valley, along with the recent birth defects, research in Appalachia and other peer-reviewed science, is providing evidence of the long-term effects of human exposure to mountaintop removal. Again, I urgently call upon the United States government to intervene and address these health issues, place an immediate moratorium on mountaintop removal, and stop this needless killing of our citizens. I have mentioned many times, and I've done commentaries, including on my Monday night commentary show, Progressive Commentary Hour, that there is no such thing as clean coal. There's no safety in gas hydrofracking. I'll be doing an original in-depth investigative report next week on why gas hydrofracking is neither safe, will not provide jobs, is not a profitable industry. It's a bubble created by speculators in the resource commodity market, and it is duping people, and you have to know the downside. So we can present this information to every member of the New York legislature and New Jersey legislature and Connecticut legislature and Pennsylvania legislators. Too late for Pennsylvania, but maybe we can still make an influence in New York. So I ask you this, for all of you who care about human lives, understand that this president and administration, the majority of the Democrats and the majority of the Republicans, have chosen in a bipartisan way to weaken our environmental laws, our Clean Air Act, our Clean Water Act, and they have all, as a group, refused to look at the consequences of mountaintop removal in Appalachia. It's rarely discussed. A one-off mention on one of the programs, you never hear it again. So we're going to keep reminding you. I'm going to go down next week for 2 days and go through Appalachia. I'm going to drive through there. I'm going to do a film on it. I'm going to put it up on YouTube. It'll be a short, like 20-minute film of showing you the consequences of living there. This is my home state. I spent my whole youth, went to college down there, grew up there, my family's still down there. And I'm not doing it just because I'm from that area. I'm doing it because it's an important issue. Anytime you have 60,000 additional cancers that we are putting people in harm's way just so that politicians can get more campaign money from the coal mine companies. Back in a moment with our guests. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you, I'm Gary Knoll. For those of you who did not have a chance last night to tune in to the 7 o'clock Progressive Commentary Hour, it's up on our website in the archives. Each week now, for 5 straight weeks, we've had more and more people each week downloading the program. There's nothing on health. It's strictly commentaries from the most progressive minds in the world on issues that are not generally given any attention in most of the media. It's a real piece of scholarship. It's for people who are serious about issues. It's a very serious piece of radio. And then I have guests on, generally one only, in depth. And then people have a chance to call in after any one of the 4 or 5 commentaries and share their points of view. And I want to thank the growing number. We should hit 180,000 downloads this week alone. That's an awful lot of people downloading a show, so I want to thank you. A quick, before my guest is up right now, and we're going to go to her in just a moment, but I believe that we have to keep sharing insights and commentary on important issues each day. One of the problems that I have faced is, how do we take injustices that anyone would agree is an injustice and motivate people to both recognize the problem and then become proactive in the solution? For those of us who are doing social activist work all the time, it's not that difficult. But there are times when you wake up and you think, gee whiz, why am I out here marching on behalf of people to help save their lives or do something important for them, and they're not even marching on their behalf? And it's very easy to get disconnected. Unless you have a real strong will on this issue, you can. And I believe that people only become active in social change movements because these movements speak to deep longings that go far beyond those of economic justice. These needs interact and overlap and rise and fall in importance depending upon the situation. For example, the civil rights movement spoke to a hunger to be connected to something bigger than oneself. But the institution that provided the base of this movement, the Black Church, thrived on its power to provide recognition in dozens of ways to its members. The women's movement initially based itself on the relationship of power of small groups, arguing that personal needs and suffering can form the basis of a political agenda. The highest periods of member engagement in the life of a labor union occur when people feel a sense of agency in standing up to a boss or during the height of a campaign. As Cesar Chavez once observed, when a man or a woman, young or old, takes a place on a picket line for even a day or two, he will never be the same again. And yet, this transparent reality is hidden from view in the work of organizers and leaders of progressive organizations who too often treat their staff, members, and the public audiences as if most of these needs are irrelevant. Instead, members and potential members are seen as motivated only by narrow economic self-interest, with staff treated as one-dimensional means to fight for that end. Corporations have understood the crucial motivational role of so-called soft, that is, non-economic needs apart from the paycheck, for decades. Almost every book on leadership published in the last 20 years emphasizes the importance of relationships and recognition. Huge studies have been done on companies that have succeeded and failed in an attempt to come up with the secret sauce of success, and invariably the answer involves the ways in which the culture of a company engages employees at levels above and beyond compensation. In a recent article, Arianna Huffington reports on a similar emphasis in advertising today, with more and more corporations explicitly touting their social engagement and desire to speak to a higher purpose. Well, for example, when was the last time you saw one of the ads for gas? Or let's say you see the scientist who is working on algae, and he's working on algae because algae is going to be a source of energy for the future. And then you see it's ExxonMobil. Okay, then you start to feel better about ExxonMobil, because, gee whiz, they have a regular person working on algae. Or a man down in the bayous who said, I'm out here in the backwater of the bayous of Mississippi, and I'm making sure that, you know, that we're keeping this water clean. And then suddenly, because you're seeing a man in a little boat who looks like our best friend next door, you think, well, it's not some giant senseless corporation. Yeah, it is, but it's how they sell themselves. They sell that soft image. Unfortunately, the left hasn't learned that very well. Too often, the left discovers its campaigns for economic justice and various aspects of the social safety net fall on cynical and resigned ears, even among our system's greatest victims. Conservative groups, on the other hand, seem better able to connect with these same victims, even though the connection seems to progressives as patently opposed to these victims' economic self-interest. The growth of megachurches, the rise of evangelical movements, and the recent popularity of the Tea Party all involve people drawn to communities that support a political and economic system inimical to their own needs for material security. The reasons, and please, for those of you who have condemned everyone who's a Tea Party person as being some kind of redneck racist idiot or indifferent, before you make that judgment, to all those who've been out there, do what I've done. Go to the meetings and talk with them one-on-one and see if you can learn anything about them except what you've been told about them from the people who've never been to the meetings, and see if it doesn't change your perspective. Because I have found the reasons have little to do with anyone's economic bottom line. Ah, what then? They do so because they appear to address multiple levels of suffering and multiple needs. So what do people need? Why do people show up? Why do they align with one person or group than another? Are we saying they don't need material security and economic justice? Of course not. Recognition doesn't put food on our table, and a sense of meaning won't stop the bank from foreclosing on our house. The American dream, an ideal in which work offers retirement security and medical benefits and generates enough income so our kids can go to college and on to a better life, is still and always should be important for people. Structural unemployment, maldistribution of income and wealth, and the economically debilitating effects of racism and sexism are blights to the human body and spirit. A movement for social change that doesn't target this blight will be irrelevant to a huge sector of the population. When people's survival needs, defined in this way, are frustrated, they suffer enormously. They get sick. In extreme cases, research shows their brains actually atrophy as a result of deprivation. Further, they often internalize their failure, blame themselves, and get depressed. They feel inadequate and inferior. They suffer from the myth that one's economic and material status is an expression of how deserving one is. A movement that doesn't speak directly to economic suffering and deprivation, whether absolute or relative, will not only be irrelevant to millions of people, but will take to place among other pie-in-the-sky movements, usually religious ones, that offer moral and spiritual bromides to the victims of material deprivation rather than directly seeking to end that deprivation. However, because the facts of inequality are obvious and objectively measurable, progressives tend to believe that if we rationally present these facts to people, they will endorse our progressive agenda. The narrative goes like this. If we could only tell our story about class privilege, Wall Street and government corruption, and economic exploitation of working people, they would see reality more clearly. Well, I believe that that narrative is naive and patronizing, and it's as old as it is wrong. It suggests that if only we had enough organizers, get enough people on the doors who could explain to people how the banks are screwing them, they'd want to join our movement. The implication is that the people are lacking knowledge or are suffering from what Marxists used to call false consciousness. Our job as progressives is to help people, in their minds, see the light. No, it isn't. This assumption is empirically false and at odds with everything we know about psychology and learning and neurobiology. Let me explain this. How can I say this as simply as possible? Feelings matter, not facts. I can't tell you how many times I presented facts, irrefutable, unchallengeable, scholarly facts about every imaginable issue, whether it's what really causes AIDS to the absurdity of AIDS diagnostic tests. It hasn't changed any of the minds of those who have their feelings about what AIDS is and is not, and the rightness of a treatment, even if the treatment is wrong and the treatment causes you to die. And too often, as political scientist Drew Weston and linguist George Lakoff have argued, the facts are inequality and injustice don't necessarily drive people to the left unless they are embedded in a message that speaks to deep feelings and values. Values and non-economic needs matter, not rational descriptions of economic reality. People have a range of desires and needs other than simply physical ones, and unless these desires and needs are understood and addressed, logic, facts, rationality, scholarship, and education will all land on deaf ears. Thus, in our fight for economic justice, our narrow view of what people want and how they listen hoists us on our own petard. It systematically gets in the way of developing healthy organizations and strategies that have a chance of engaging people's passions. And without engaging people's passions, you will never create a movement that has political power. If we take our blinders off and we see and read about evidence of the foundational importance of non-economic needs and values every day, a terrorist commits suicide for the sake of Allah. A monk lights himself on fire to protest against dictatorship. An Indian demonstrator at a salt mine walks directly into the violent batons of the British Army in nonviolent resistance for the cause of independence. An African-American marcher sits down in front of Bull Connor's dogs. A Marine risks his life for his buddy. A parent does the same for a child. Babies who are fed but not held get sick and can even die. People endure hardships all the time out of love for the families or partners. How many times have we seen even investment bankers, ones I've counseled, who have quit high-paying jobs for the benefits of working in environments that are more collegial, kinder, and less fixated on the immediate bottom line? If given the choice between more money and more recognition and autonomy, most people give up the money. Most activists we've worked with and in labor unions routinely give up higher-paying jobs in the private sector to work for social change. The centrality of non-economic human needs and longings are hiding in plain sight. To the extent that our common sense twists Abraham Maslow's pyramid of human needs, which I challenge, to mean that we can't gratify higher needs until we've addressed more basic survival needs, we're misled and our organization's doomed to founder. Such a bias not only ignores a mountain of psychological research, it also contradicts our own basic human experience. It's not just that they who have these five needs, it's us. It's not just workers who need more agency, or children who need more recognition, or members who need to have a greater sense of meaning. It's us. Too often, the organizers, activists, and leaders on the left frame their work as being in the service of others. We're trying to help other people, the less advantaged, the powerless, the victimized. In so doing, we routinely leave ourselves out. We deny that we have the same economic and non-economic needs as those we're allegedly fighting for. We fight for the right to leisure time, but deny to ourselves. We try to help them feel efficacious and inspired, but work for organizations that provide neither. And where there's nothing but pitted social warfare, try then donating time where the people involved have lost the meaning of the word love, compassion, sensitivity, and kindness. These needs are what it means to be a human being. Get beyond your identity as a left, a right, conservative, or liberal. These are irrelevant terms today. They have no functional meaning for the future. They are archaic, and only a dinosaur could still label themselves, moniker themselves with these, and still feel essential to the future. What we are is we must animate the good things, and we must focus on the unhealthy frustration that can lead us to do bad things. The human locomotive of motivation carries these needs, the existence of or importance of which can no longer be debated. The only question for progressives is whether we get on board. I'm Gary Knoll, my thoughts and Michael Badger. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
The moment I wake up.
Let's say hello to Dr. Judy Wood. I've already given you her introduction. Nice to have you back with us, Dr. Wood.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Wood, I'm going to give you several lead-ins. I'm then going to sit back and ask you to please give us your research and your perspectives on these. You've already given us insights on two previous shows of what of the anomalies are between the official version of how those buildings at 9/11 came down and what you believe is the actual proof after forensically examining 40,000 slides. Now let's go to a more essential question. Let's assume for a moment that you are correct. I happen to think that two of you are correct. I believe that there was you who is correct in determining that there is a energetic effects, but I also believe that there was a redundancy system of that I will talk about on another program, which we have, of the thermitic explosives. But in any case, let's take a look at what kind of science would be needed today in order for this phenomena to have occurred, and go through this. I'm not asking you to mention any names of organizations. We're not doing that. We're only going to talk about what we have some very specific evidence for. And also with that, please tell us about the work of John Hutchinson on slow bending of metals, shredding and fracturing and gelification of metals, of melding without heat, of metal illuminance without heat, of materials changing their elemental levels, of anti-gravity activity. All of these are meteorological examinations that you are an expert in. So some would say this is just a very weird phenomena, but okay, such as the M holes, the holes in the materials and the round holes in glass. And go through this and give us your insight, please.
Okay. First of all, I don't really deal with theories or speculation or, guessing. I'm just looking at the evidence and what the evidence shows. It's kind of the equivalent of adding, 2 plus 3 and getting 5 instead of starting out with a series of numbers that could be the answer and guessing which one's right and then looking at the problem. Just start out with a problem, and everybody should be on the same page. There's a list of really weird anomalies that we've talked about in the past. And looking at those, weird phenomena going on. What causes that type of thing? What actually physically is going on? And by doing that, you sort of back-engineer the mechanism that caused it. And then while I was looking at that, I happened upon the work of John Hutchinson that mimics all of the same characteristics. What I find really strange is that, throughout history, if you look at a timeline of the development of various things, think of it, 600 BC, someone discovered static electricity. But then it wasn't until the late 1700s, early 1800s, when someone started playing with it and realizing they could make a battery and developing electricity. And then when Tesla came along, he developed the hydroelectric power plant. That's only recent, if you look at the whole timeline. So why is it that nothing happens and suddenly something happens? And then nothing happens for a while. It's almost like people have the kind of self-permission to think outside the box.
Could you address the issues directly, though?
Of the mechanisms exactly?
Yes. In other words, what you put a challenge out to the world. You said that these buildings could not have collapsed based upon the laws of physics, structural engineering, and you showed, and you, I think you very dramatically proved, that you showed gigantic steel in the middle of the air that would have had no heat affecting it, and yet they dissolved before they hit the ground. That meant in less than 10 seconds, gigantic steel beams dissolved and never hit the ground. You also had steel beams from the major building that were standing erect, the last things to fall, and then they didn't fall. There was no steel beam found on the ground where there should have been. They simply dissolved. Now, these are very dramatic things. You saw people who went out windows without propulsion behind them far further than what Carl Lewis, an Olympian long jumper, could have jumped out. So you showed enough anomalies to show something happened. I'm asking you to please tell us what you believed caused these and the science behind these.
Well, I can look at how you can reproduce these same effects.
Okay, that's good.
Which is the work of John Hutchison. There's also natural phenomena. If you study hurricanes, tornadoes, you know, we've seen cars sitting on top of telephone poles. People assume that they're blown there or sucked up. Where does that energy come from? It exists everywhere, but it needs to be tapped into. And it turns out if you have the right combination of things, you can tap into it, which is what John Hutchison does. He creates a static field, and within the static field interferes various radio frequency signals, like microwave. It's not the microwave energy. It's not the static field. It's the combination. It's like, think of a key that unlocks a door. Sure, they have these super colliders and various ways of, you know, doing horrendous projects. It's kind of like getting in a house by bulldozing your way in, where John Hutchison just uses a key and walks in the front door. It's this key that unlocks the energy that's everywhere. And again, we see it happen naturally with tornadoes. It's just the right combination at the right time, and up pops a tornado. If you look at a tornado, you know, I've got some videos on my website. It's an energy field that just happens. It isn't, you know, like a big vacuum cleaner pulling things up or tearing things apart, because some of them come up from the ground. And, you know, if you add up the amount of energy required to tear something up, in the conventional sense, it'd be a horrendous amount of energy. So we can know for sure that this type of thing exists naturally. And the car sitting on the telephone pole, there's evidence that it's been levitated there. In other words, gravity has been turned off or reversed. Now, how does that happen? We have the effects of electricity, magnetism, and gravity, and they're all interrelated. I think we've all, as you know, early on, experimented with wrapping a wire around a nail, plugging into a 9-volt battery, and turning that nail into a magnet. Also, if you move a conductor through a magnetic field, you get electricity. So those two are easy to interchange. It turns out that if you install a magnet, there's an example on my website of this experiment where folks got magnets, you know, that orientation where they like each other, like north-south, and embed them in a rock, and then have a rock without magnetized metal in it, but not magnetized, drop them. The one with the magnets oriented to like each other will drop faster. Now orient the magnets so they don't like each other, north-south, north-south, north-north, south-south, so forth, and bolt them together, stick them inside the rock, drop them, and it falls more slowly. So magnetism can affect gravity. So when you see things like cars being levitated during a storm, you have to wonder, what, you know, during an electrical storm, there is this interaction. It also affects things on the molecular level. And instead of for example, atoms being attracted to each other, they repel each other. And that appears to be what happened on 9/11.
I'm not clear on this. I'm going to go through some anomalies here, and I just want you to give me either a yes or no answer, and then if it's no, explain it. If it's yes, explain it, all right?
Okay.
we now can see from your work that there were 1,400 what you call toasted cars spontaneously. In other words, there was no heat on the cars. There was no reason these cars should have caught on fire. But in some of the cases, parts of the car, like the engine, was on fire, but the inside was not. We also saw that there were cars tossed about, that based upon the physics of how the buildings collapse, these cars were far enough away that there would have been no reason for these cars to have been tossed, because other cars were perfectly in place, and suddenly one car in a line of six would be jumped out of place. You also talk about the problem of insufficient seismic signal, meaning when the Building 7 collapsed, there was no signal there that could have explained that collapse. You also talk about molten steel, melting steel, from eyewitness reports and the fires, but there was where did that come from? These are, and then a tornado warnings off Long Island, the thunder reported by airports that few people know about, but that was connected, you're saying. So here's what I'm asking. Are you suggesting that the collapse and the anomalies, the physics anomalies that we saw, were spontaneous and with no human intervention or cause or planning? Yes or no?
Probably no, because it's so defined.
Okay, so then that leaves us with that there had to be, for all of this to be defined to these buildings and no others, at this extreme situation and no others, at the same time these planes were crashing into the buildings and no others, except for Building 7, that these occurred. So then what, you're giving us an idea that you're explaining that there is, it's dealing with anti-gravitational fields and other forms of energy. Now, who would have that kind of capacity or knowledge? Or it would take a lot of people working to create something this likely. Is there anyone right now doing research in this area? Is there anything that we would could gain from, let's say, the Winter Haven Project and Thomas Brown's work on the relationship of electromagnetic and gravitational fields, something that was also part of Hutchinson's effect?
It's not necessary to have a whole lot of people involved. You know, John Hutchinson can do it on a small scale by himself with very little input power. It's not, you know, like loading up a building with bombs and whatnot, because nothing needs to be loaded into the building. It's just about creating the energy field.
Would someone go about creating the energy field?
Well, here's an example that I think most everyone is familiar with, a cell phone. There's cell phone towers around. You don't really pay much attention to where the cell phone tower is as long as you are within a range of the cell phone tower. Then your cell phone works, providing you have operational batteries and so forth. The cell phone tower by itself doesn't provide the communication, nor does the cell phone by itself. It's a combination of the two. You have the cell phone within the range of the cell phone tower, and it works. And it doesn't take hundreds of people to install a cell phone tower. Well, maybe it does now, but or to operate a cell phone. It's the interaction between the two. And so if you have, the general field, the equivalent to the cell phone tower, the general field, and then have something that acts within that to unlock that energy in a specific place, there you have it.
So let me understand what you're saying. Are you saying that you believe that some individual or individuals working together, based upon John Hutchinson, what he can do in producing this this unique phenomena, that individuals could have brought down the towers, but because you have no proof that they exist, you're only basing this upon a projection of that the towers came down, but not because of what we were told, not because of the planes flying into them. Therefore, the technology exists, though it has not been made public, And there are few individuals who know about this technology, but we're not even talking about secret government agencies that could possibly be doing this, because we know that the government has multiple secret projects going on, including HAARP, and that they would then also have to have motive. They would have to have coordinates and timing. They would have to have known about all the other things involved in this prior to this occurring, because it would have been perfect timing. So now you're not talking about a few people now. If we accept your premise that someone else caused this to happen, there would have had to have been thousands of people probably involved.
I don't understand where you're coming up with the thousands of people business. If you need, you know, I'm not looking at motives. I'm not looking at who has whatever technology and who does what, where, when, and so forth. I'm looking at the physical evidence and what the physical evidence shows, not what my opinion is or thoughts are or projections are or speculations are. I'm just looking at the physical evidence.
Okay, and we're accepting, right now, Dr. Wood, we're accepting that you have given us some unique insights. But please take your science hat off for a moment. Because that meant that the person or persons who created this science would not have done that had there not been planes flying into it. They would have had to have plausible deniability. So plausible deniability would have meant that they would have had to have been aware of these planes coming, and therefore the plot of these, which meant that they would have had to have been associated with the national security agencies. Then you start multiplying how many different people would have had to be involved if what you're saying is correct. Right now, we're dealing with a hypothesis. We're dealing with a theory. We're dealing with something you have spent years working on, enormous amount of time, and you are a specialist in your field as a former professor in a unique and specialized field of biomaterial composition and biomimicry. It's very few people in this. So you're giving us your facts, and I'm saying, okay, if we take your facts as being accurate, then there had to have been people involved. Track it back, then would those towers have fallen if there would have not been two planes going into them? Suddenly, if it's just the all three buildings collapse without any physical attack, what is the probability of that happening? So therefore, the physical attack would have had to have been a part of this, and they would have to have known about all that. They had to have known about all the people involved, that it had to have been a part of this whole thing in order to have gained something that they needed. What did they need for this to happen? No one does something like this at this magnitude unless they had a motive. We both agree upon one thing that's important here. We agree that an anomaly has occurred. We agree that that the planes flying into the buildings could not have created the heat, nor was the structure so weak that it would have caused this pancake collapse in this, what was it, 10.2 seconds or 10.1 seconds, that this was not possible. We also, based upon your outstanding scholarship, found anomalies that were in clear view, but no one took the time to look at them for what they were, because they had already, on a gestalt level, had accepted the official version. And unfortunately, once you accept the official version, you're no longer open to looking at alternatives, even if the evidence is right in plain sight. Because of your unique background in scholarship and academia and science, you were able to prove forensically your points. They have not been refuted that I can find thus far in the literature, and we looked. What that brings us to now is, in my opinion, and I'm sharing my opinion on this, that we must now examine motive and opportunity and resources. Who would have had the opportunity and the resources and the motive to have caused this to happen because of the timing? I cannot rule out that someone would have had to have been fully aware that the terrorists were going to hijack the planes, that these planes would have gone towards the World Trade Center, that they would have known about this for some substantial period of time before, and they would have had the means of protecting themselves and covering it up once this was done, in spite of the fact that there were multiple witnesses who heard explosions going off and who saw things that were later discounted or not even allowed to testify under the official version. We also know unequivocally that the official version was a complete and total fraud, that there is now need for a new inquiry. My suggestion would be this. The government's not going to admit anything. They will already have destroyed the evidence and probably eliminated any of the people who were vulnerable to them, as they did in the JFK assassination. So there's a high probability that under no court of law and no freedom of information will these people have left a paper trail or a fingerprint. But that doesn't mean that they're not out there. That doesn't mean they haven't done this, and it doesn't mean they wouldn't do it again. So I have to look at the other end of it. And I look at this end, who benefited from 9/11? Now, it's hard to imagine that, and people don't ask themselves that question. What has happened since 9/11 that would have allowed someone, if they were creating this scenario, and I'm merely using this as a hypothesis, how would they have benefited? And now we look at the Patriot Act, we look at the different militarization, the $7 trillion, that's T, trillion spent in the military-industrial complex, the Patriot Act, which eviscerated our rights, the search and seizures, the taken away of habeas corpus, the Homeland Security Act, 19 separate governmental agencies working in secret with non-defined budgets and black ops sites, with all the military-industrial and spy contractors working together. Tremendous amounts of power, money, and influence have shifted post 9/11. Now, that only means that we can prove is factual. It does not mean that that's causative to this. It's merely one piece of a puzzle that still has a question mark. I'll leave you with the final thoughts, please.
It could easily be someone, exploiting the event. Let me give you a scenario to think of. Let's say you're one of five people and want to take over the U.S. You can't just go in the front door because the U.S. military will come get you. So you have this technology, can dustify the towers, and then you start an organization from within the U.S. convincing everybody that it's the U.S. government's bad, go attack the U.S. government from within, destroy the country from within, so they want any government but the one they have. And then you just walk in the front door, and they welcome you with open arms. That's another scenario.
Okay, I appreciate you sharing that scenario. Again, we at the end of the day, all that we have right now are your hard forensic statistics. My thought is I would like to see you on national television in a debate with any of the members of the original 9/11 Truth Commission, to present your evidence, to see how they would cross-examine your facts and your evidence, and you would have a chance to cross-examine theirs with the whole public watching this. I would have the confidence that your facts would virtually decimate anything that anyone from the government or any of its experts would put forth, and that would cause the American public then to ask the question, what did these people know? And I cannot believe at this time, with what you've written and what you've done, that all agencies of the government have not looked at you very carefully, your work very carefully, tried to find flaws in it, tried to discredit you in any way they can. That's the way they work. And I have not seen anyone thus far being able to discredit your work. So kudos to you for the outstanding job you're doing. We're just trying to put these pieces together. It's all theoretical at this moment, except for the forensic evidence. That is not theoretical. That is hard science. And I commend you for all your outstanding work, Dr. Judy Wood.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to another conversation.
Thanks.
Dr. Judy Wood is a former professor at Clemson University Department of Mechanical Engineering, specializing in the research of thermal stress and deformation analysis with optical imaging and biomaterial composition and biomimicry. She is one of America's, if not the world's, leading experts in the field of optical methods of stress analysis to determine interference patterns and their effects. She's authored over 60 peer-reviewed research papers in the peer-reviewed journals, and she based her findings after years of work on analyzing 40,000 images and video clips and volumes of witness testimony. And her findings led to her file a federal Quantum case for scientific fraud against the contractors who controlled the official 9/11 Commission report. And that led to a 500-page book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Direct Free Energy Technology on 9/11. And there's another group who believe that it was thermitic explosives. I believe they were both correct. I believe that whoever was behind this had a backup plan. There's always a backup plan. You know, it's like the Sicilian mob. They would send a hitman out, and they would send a hitman to the hitman, then a hitman to the hitman, so nobody ever knew which of the godfathers put out the hit. It's called redundancy. It's almost in every one of these surreptitious situations. And if you want more reading, I suggest that you look at the work of Edward Ledskalin, L-E-E-D-S-K-A-L-N-I-N, who was able to cut and move limestone up to 35 tons with simple tools. That's more than the pyramid blocks. And Thomas Brown and the Winter Haven Project, experimenting with the relationship between electromagnetic and gravitational fields, something that John Hutchinson does, and he's able to bend metals without touching them. Interesting, his work, and I'll be looking to have John Hutchinson on to actually, when my studio gets done another week, I'm going to try to have him on or go up to film him actually doing all this and then have him on and have this videoed. While in the new studio, it's much like a television you can watch. You'll be able to see him doing all this as I'm interviewing him. If you'd like to see the best forensic evidence that we could find of Dr. Judy Wood, go up to progressiveradionetwork.com. I want to say thank you for all of our stations. We went over about 9 minutes today, but I felt it was important to get this information in. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all very much for listening.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.